Good morning and welcome to the Sports Polygamy Podcast. I'm Eric George and it's Thursday, the 31st of January 2013. And I am quite excited to be joined by my main lover, Kirk Dalziel. How are you, Kirk?
Good, Eric, good. I'm tired from a weekend of camping. I decided to go camping and fishing and do manly things rather than oppress minorities, run around screaming Australia and yelling at foreigners.
So was it an Australia Day or an invasion day for you?
I took myself out of it. I was scared the country was going to implode or get swamped by slow leaky boats.
Terrific. Well, I'm glad to see you're cashing in on all the man credits you've built up with a beard and flannel over the past 12 minutes or so.
Hey, I caught some fish. I couldn't afford it. Felt any manlier if I tried.
Yeah? Did you rip their guts out with your bare hands?
Oh, with my teeth, Eric. What are you kidding? Your hands?
All right. So this week, obviously, is going to be dominated by the Super Bowl because that's where it's at. Monday is going to be a pretty big day for both of us, I assume.
I've already called in sick.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. I told work not to even bother. I'm not turning up.
Have we got a prediction from Rhonda or Brenda or whatever her name is?
Oh, Brenda. No, she only does rugby.
Okay.
She's not down with the NFL. She's just a rugby girl.
Okay. Well, before we get to specific predictions, I thought it would be worthwhile to quickly talk about the concept of the NFL as a grand final, because I think in America and across the globe, it really is quite a different grand final to just about anything you see in another competition. It's so focused on spectacle first, and almost the game is the secondary component in what you get out of Super Bowl Sunday. I mean, this obviously we've just had media day gone by, and there's a lot of stories that have been generated by that. How do you let's start with this, Kirk? How do you rank the Super Bowl in terms of the grand finals and days you look forward to most in the year of sport?
In terms of spectacle, it's number one. This is just the greatest display of over the top patriotism, corporate horrorism, and just taking everything else but the game over the top. I mean, the game, like many grand finals, is usually all about whoever makes a mistake rather than being an exciting spectacle. So they've created this massive aura about the whole thing. They let it build up for 2 weeks. The media just go crazy and beat the hell out of it. And then everything about the game is so overly over the top. And so America, it's not even funny. It's just it's blatant. It's blatant patriotism, and it's great.
Yeah, for me, actually, almost the biggest highlight every year, or the high watermark for me, is the 5 minutes before the game starts. You get the national anthem, which is almost always amazing. Christina Aguilera's one from a couple of years ago, even though she got the words wrong, stands out to me as a very memorable one recently. They have the Jets fly over. They have basically the entire stadium enveloped in fireworks. You know, they get the music pumping and everything. I can't imagine how that translates in the stadium, at least, although it seems very loud. But I think this is where the Super Bowl really is a strength. Is as a TV viewer, it's incredible.
Look, nothing fires you up more in a stadium than stuff exploding. I can assure you of that. Luke and I were at the Green Bay Packers game against Minnesota, and they did a flyover at that game. And I can't even begin to tell you how much that fires you up. I was ready to tear people's heads off. Just three jets, because you can't hear them at all. And then there's 3 or 4 seconds when they just roar over the stadium. And you just can't help but scream and yell. It's incredible. And then everything explodes and the whole night sky erupts. It's so much fun.
Yeah, it's great. The Super Bowl halftime show obviously generally gets a lot of attention as a spectacle. I think it's almost always disappointing. I think there's been some good ones in recent history. Prince, Bruce Springsteen, Paul McCartney were all fun. I thought The Who, Madonna, and the Black Eyed Peas were all carnage, bordering on, you know, a complete disaster.
Well, you know what happens. They get these modern acts in who feel like they have to do something special or something spectacular. Be like Tom Petty when Tom Petty was on there. He just played the songs, and he was damn good.
Yeah.
I think Beyonce is going to be incredible. I mean, she's not going to fart around with anything. She'll get out there and belt out the classics and get everyone going. And that's the way it should be. Just get up there, sing, give us what we want. Don't flip us the bird. Don't whip a 40-year-old titty out. Just sing, please. That's all I want.
Okay. Well, look, I think we can all agree that, you know, in terms of spectacle, it's, you know, it's hard to beat footage of Clay Matthews crying while someone screams the American national anthem. But what about the actual sporting product in terms of the game itself? How do you rank that in terms of a grand final setup?
I don't rate it any more than any other grand final you watch. The players become so tight, and you just don't want to make a mistake, and that's the issue. It's not like a regular season game where you can really go after it. Because, you know, if you cock it up, well, there's always next week you can win another one. So everyone just plays a little bit within themselves, which is always a bit of a shame. But that happens in every grand final you usually see, whether it be the AFL or rugby union. I mean, the Chiefs one last year was a bit of a blowout, but that was because the South Africa team had travelled twice around the globe just to get to the game. So it's just the same sort of thing. I mean, it's still good fun to watch because the pressure's so huge. You're always nervous. Even if you don't have a team in the grand final, you're nervous. But it's always just a little bit down.
Yeah, I certainly agree in the case of American football. I mean, you only need to look at these playoffs we've just seen where, you know, the divisional rounds normally where you see the best football, where the kind of the stakes are still going up, but the pressure isn't so high that it's insurmountable for the players. But I'm not totally sure I agree with you in terms of this being the same case in all sports. I mean, I'd certainly argue that some of the grand finals I've seen in the AFL recently, purely as a game, have been some of the best games I've seen of Australian football. You know, Geelong St Kilda, the Sydney Hawthorn one last year were two standouts for me. So I do wonder sometimes whether the way that they build up to this game and the amount of focus they put on these players and the amount of things they ask them to do other than just prepare for the game creates more pressure and tension than you see in other sports.
Well, it's like when you tell a joke, Eric. If you start off with, this is really funny, it has to be real damn funny. Otherwise, it's going to suck. And that's the same thing with the Super Bowl. If you build it up so much to being the greatest game in the world, if it's not the greatest game in the world, you suddenly feel let down. Whereas if it's something like the AFL where you have a bit of a parade and everyone gets excited for a few days, but ultimately everyone goes to work. And if you're not, well, I imagine in Melbourne it's different, but when you're living out here, it's not always the headline and all the rest of it, unless West Coast you're in. So if you build it up too much and you expect it to be the best game ever, then you're sorely let down when it's not.
What about if you look at the actual structure of the Super Bowl itself? There's a few interesting things, I think. Well, the first one for me is the fact that it moves around every year. Do you wish this was like the AFL or like, you know, rugby league or whatever, these competitions where they have a hallowed ground where you have to win at the end of the year? Or do you think it's cool having this kind of roaming party around the country that kind of oscillates between different cities?
Well, I think the big problem is that people all bitch in America if it's just in one city. The reason it is in the AFL is because Melbourne has such a monopoly over the whole country in terms of having a huge supporter base there. So no matter what happens, it's going to pack out 80,000 people.
Yeah.
I like the idea of roaming it around the country and giving each city a chance to see a Super Bowl because it's a hell of an opportunity to see the biggest spectacle in America. I mean, it's like the British and Irish Lions coming to New Zealand, South Africa, Australia. You'd like them to come to your country because you want to see it. I think they need to go up north again, though. I don't like this always playing in warm weather or playing in a dome. Get up north, play some cold games, make some people uncomfortable.
Well, was it Dallas, I remember. Was it Dallas or Indianapolis they played at recently where they assumed they were going to get good weather and they ended up getting a, you know, frozen tundra. Obviously not indoors, but outside all the roads and everything were frozen over. But I agree. I think especially because it's such a huge part of, you know, what comprises NFL mythology, snow games and, you know, January football and all that kind of stuff. It might hurt the halftime show, but at least put it in a, you know, Minnesota or something, you know, a stadium that's got an indoor element in the cold place.
Just put the 32 teams in a hat, pull a name out. Once that team's gone, they can't have it for another 32 years. Done.
I guess to use an analogy to, you know, to your sport, golf, this is like comparing the British Open to, you know, to the Masters, where they roam it around in Britain and give everyone a show, and in the Masters it's just always Augusta.
Yeah, exactly. But I like the idea. I think it's good.
Now, the other one that I think also stands out to me, and it's something I actually think I personally really like about the Super Bowl, is although obviously you get this kind of awkwardness in American football because it's played across two calendar years. So you'd say, is it the 2013 Super Bowl or is it the 2012 season Super Bowl? But they get around that with this concept of numbering the Super Bowls, and we're up to 40, mid-40s. 45, there you go. And so it almost becomes this thing where you can remember each one. It's almost packaged not as a continuous thing, but each one is a distinct event. And obviously they create a new trophy every time, although they all look the same. So you have Super Bowl 45 was a thing, and that's done. And now Super Bowl 46 is in a new city, and it's a new game with new teams and new halftime act. And so it almost reminds me a little bit of wrestling with WrestleMania and, you know, all these things where they're separately packaged as events that happened and they're never to be repeated, and that's why they're special.
I like it as well. I think it's a good idea. I'll join in on that. What I don't like is all the X's, V's, and I's. I could just give me a number. Put 45 down. I don't want to have to go to MIT or have a mass major just to figure out what the hell's going on. Just give me a straight 45.
Okay, so we've said the stuff that we like about it. We've said some of the stuff we don't like about it. Is there anything else that you'd change about the Super Bowl to improve it?
Don't have media day.
No?
I don't like media day.
You don't like Ed Reed telling the recently deceased Junior Seau that he knew what he was getting into when he got depression and committed suicide?
Yeah, that you shouldn't let the players out at this time. Don't put them out there. T-Sizzle will say something dumb. Ray Lewis will be dancing for an hour. They interview the punter. Nobody cares about the punter.
Punters are people too. Come on.
Yeah, well...
No, I agree. It's rough. It's almost a difficult thing. I mean, people in Australia complain about the lead-up to the AFL Grand Final or State of Origin, but fuck, the amount of hoops that people have to jump through for the NFL media is mental.
It's nothing. They just sit them down and grill them and ask all sorts of ridiculous questions. I'm surprised they're not still asking Ray Lewis if he killed a guy. They sit them down and eviscerate them, just completely barrage them with questions. It's nuts.
Yeah, I think that's a good call. I almost feel like they should switch back to a one-week layover. I think it'd be more entertaining. I find it frustrating, to be honest, as a Patriots fan. It's something I've noticed a couple of times, is you get this huge high point when you win the championship game. You're so happy about it. And then 2 weeks later, you kind of have to work yourself up again. You lose the momentum of excitement for the game.
Yeah, I don't like the two-week break. Two-week break isn't good. Just get rid of the Pro Bowl, play the Super Bowl the next week. Keep everyone pumped.
Yeah.
Keep everyone excited. And then it's also going to coordinate with Australia Day. So if it's on a weekend, I get Monday off. I could have watched it this weekend. Look, what else I love about the Super Bowl, it's not even sports related. The ads, Eric.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to it. You really need to find a stream, Kirk, or get League Pass or something just for the day, because being able to watch the American version of it and not have to put up with whatever dipshits one HD is going to get to do the halftime show is fantastic to get the American version.
Yeah, I might do. Hopefully they have a Super Bowl special that I can get in on. I'll happily pay for that, but I'm not going to pay $60 if it's on one.
Okay, well, let's have a look at the game in specific at this point. Obviously, it is San Francisco and Baltimore. Two reasonably surprising sides, and two sides that changed drastically in the month leading up to the Super Bowl. San Francisco have been installed as marginal favorites in this game, Kirk. Do you agree with that?
God, I don't know what the hell to think anymore with this Baltimore team. I thought they were going to be done in the second week, but they keep coming back and keep going. I don't know what the hell to believe, but I'm probably going to tip San Francisco. But the Ravens have just come out of nowhere. Everyone thought they were dead at the end of the season.
Okay, so here's the question marks about both teams, because their identities have translated drastically in this playoffs playoff run that they've really transformed themselves. So for San Francisco, they've been so explosive offensively. Obviously, this has been the big change, but they've done it against the Green Bay Packers and the Atlanta Falcons, two average to middling defenses who are missing a lot of personnel. Now they're coming up against the Baltimore Ravens, who are more experienced and physical. For Baltimore, they're this deep passing team that have, you know, really managed to intimidate their opposition every week and beat them up. There's one team you're not going to, you know, outmuscle in the NFL. It's San Francisco. They've got so much aggression and, you know, self-belief that they're going to stand right up. And I almost think they'd be able to overpower Baltimore in an arm wrestle. So which of those two kind of question marks do you think presents a bigger problem for the team.
I think the Ravens are going to be screwed with the physicality, especially in the run game. These guys are a bit of a leaky ship when it comes to stopping the run game. And the Niners are incredible at running it up. They've got such a big physical offensive line. So I think they're going to push around T. Sizzle and the rest of them.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this the width that San Francisco plays with could give them problems, because if Kaepernick's just sitting back there all day, which he won't, and letting T. Sizzle run in a straight line and, you know where he's going, then that's one thing. But if he's having to deal with a read option every second play and guys running past his face all the time, that's a very different prospect for a big, aggressive guy.
It's confusing. I mean, it's tough going up against Kaepernick because he's a very good passer out of the pocket. We've seen, because he only ran on two attempts the conference match, and he was just lasering them. He's got such a cannon for an arm. He was throwing 98 mile an hour fastballs as a pitcher, apparently, at one point. He's a big, strong lad, and he throws it deep. He doesn't do these little short passes, and the width could be a problem as well.
Yeah, I agree. So the question there, obviously, is can you trust a second-year player, essentially a rookie, you know, someone who's played 8 NFL games to this point, started in 8 NFL games. Can you trust him in the biggest game of his career against an experienced, aggressive, intimidating defense?
Well, what you should be asking me, Eric, is whether I trust Pollard to go out there and kill Kaepernick.
Oh, God.
I mean, it could happen. He's not going to kill Gore. Nobody can kill Gore. So he'll probably get a nice helmet-to-helmet on Kaepernick.
I think the only player who we'd really have any chance of is Randy Moss, because Moss is the only one on that team with a little bit of the, you know, Patriots still in him. Pollard only works against New England Patriots.
Well, who knows? Maybe he'll change it up in this match. I guess I have to. Kaepernick's been down by 7 early. He's been down by 17 and come back and won a game. So he doesn't seem to be fazed. I mean, when he was down 17-0, he wasn't rushing, he wasn't hurrying. He looked cool as a cucumber, as my mum used to say. So I don't know if this actually fazes him that much.
Yeah. This is a problem, though. This is a very different defense to the ones that weren't fazing him before. No one managed to get any real pressure on him at all so far.
Yeah, well, that'll be interesting to see whether he can get that as well. But a lot of that's because of the read option. I mean, they couldn't rush up the guts. Because he'd just take off, so they had to keep sort of popping around the outside to contain him. Because if you do just blow through, he can take off and get around you. So I think just his perfect ratio of speed, size, and passing strength really helps him a lot. But, hey, it's a conference game. He's down by 17 points, and he comes back. I can't argue with the young man. Maybe ignorance is bliss, Eric.
Maybe. You're certainly painting him as the Renaissance man of the NFL here.
Hey, I got to watch him tear the Bears apart. So this is...
The defense is, I think, if anything, we give a slight edge to San Francisco, although obviously the Ravens have an edge in experience. I think the running game, would you agree, is a wash really here?
Oh, man, Frank Gore's going to run it up big time.
Yeah, but Ray Rice is an effective runner as well. I'm just saying, when you compare the two teams, I think they're roughly even in terms of at least what their tailbacks can do in running ball.
In terms of the running game, there's going to be a lot in the running game. A lot of this will depend on whether Joe Flacco can get the ball deep.
That was going to be my next question, is Mr. Elite. Can he show up in the Super Bowl?
I think the cornerbacks on the 49ers are better than he's probably seen the last few weeks, so he may struggle being able to just bomb it out. I don't think he's going to get away with what he's been doing so far in the playoffs. He has been incredibly good, but he hasn't faced truly great cornerbacks yet.
That's true. The one thing I think that will really impact this in terms of how it's going to go is the pass rush that they can get on Flacco, because for whatever reason, I don't know what kind of magic, you know, Gatorade they've been giving that offensive line, but they have humbled some pretty, you know, effective pass rushes over the last couple of weeks. The Colts got a bit of pressure on Flacco, but the Broncos and the Patriots basically couldn't get a hand on him. And if they can do that same thing again, then I think Flacco can step up and make passes. But I think if Flacco gets rattled, gets knocked around a bit, I think that's a very different prospect, because he's not, I mean, he can kind of run, but he's not comfortable scrambling around and throwing once he's mobile. He's much happier just sitting back there and tossing bombs.
No, it looks like a newborn giraffe when he starts running with it. So you don't want to see him doing that. But he can drop a bomb, so he just needs a couple of big plays, and the the right back in this, but I'm going to say that San Francisco have a 61% chance of winning it here.
Yeah, this is a very difficult game to call. And I agree with you for so many reasons, but if there's one thing I've learned in the NFL that's more than anything else when it comes to Super Bowls, it's that narrative matters more than anything else. It just seems like the teams that come in and they feel, it just feels like it's their time and they believe in themselves, they're the ones that more often than not raise the trophy. So I'm going to say Baltimore have a 52% chance of winning.
Well, that was based purely on my statistics, based on gut, given that I just lost my 49ers hat / had it stolen at the pool. That is an omen, so they will lose based on that.
You're hedging your bets.
Yeah, no, I'm gonna jump on the back of Baltimore. Also, God hates Cleveland, so you can't argue with God.
So, as we promised last week, we're just going to quickly touch on the conclusion of the Australian Open. It was a busy weekend of sport. Obviously, in Australia, we had the 2020s on, which were astounding. But the tennis wrapped up in Melbourne. Lina lost to Azarenka in a bit of a disappointing game. I didn't think there was a whole lot to it. But I think really, for better or for worse right now, tennis is all happening in the men's side of the draw. And it was another really fascinating installment in the drama of both Djokovic and Murray's career in that final. Did you think that it's Murray obviously lost in four sets. He just couldn't handle the game physically towards the end. His ankle was just mush. It was pretty gross to look at, and he wore out. He refused to blame that after the game. But do you look at this as a clear win for Djokovic, or has this got a bit of an asterisk over it, Kirk?
Oh, no, it has an asterisk, no doubt. Djokovic had 2 days rest on a three-setter where he only where he won, what, 2-2-1, something like that. So he only played for a couple of hours and they got 2 days off. Murray had an absolute nightmare against Federer and was playing at all hours of the night, had his feet cut up pretty bad, his hamstring looked pretty sore, and he had 1 day off. So he can't say that he wasn't tired. I mean, that's just absurd. I think maybe he's still not quite fit enough, because Djokovic seemed to bounce back from his big five-setter pretty easily, but I just think he was worn out. He could keep up with him in the first set and boast of the way through the second, but after that he just didn't have anything left in the tank.
Yeah, it was tough to watch, and I mean, he's such a naked player. He's someone who just puts it all out there, so it was pretty clear. Even the commentators kind of called it halfway through the third set. They just said, look, he's just gassed at this point. And it was a shame. But there's a few interesting notes here, I think. The first one is Djokovic, as we mentioned last week, is just physically insane for a tennis player. He's so far ahead of everybody else. Because last year, he played something, what was it, like 11 hours of tennis in the space of 3 days, because he had that epic semifinal against Murray and then the long final against Nadal. And that didn't seem to faze him at all. And then Murray had a lengthy semi, yes, and the same turnaround that Djokovic had last year, and he could barely make it four sets.
Yeah, look, he was renowned for having to pull out of matches and breaking down. I mean, so often he'd get hurt, and for some reason he suddenly become uber fit. Maybe he's gotten to the Pilates and Bikram yoga and all the rest of it. But you're right, he's just so far ahead of everybody physically that I can't see him losing too often, although Murray has improved a hell of a lot since Lendl has become his coach, who may be the most emotionless person I've ever met.
He's a golem. He's a bloody stone golem, just a statue on the sideline. I think it's a nice contrast for Murray to have somebody that stable in his box, though.
Well, could you imagine what would happen if you hit a bad forehand at training and looked across and saw that?
Just
you'd be out there for another 2 hours. Yeah, you'd be out there for another 2 hours. Oh, God, no.
Yeah. But there's more to it than even that, I think. Because, well, firstly, let's deal with the scheduling thing just very quickly. This is a thing I don't understand. So this is obviously a question a lot of people raise. I think it's unfair that Murray had, you know, the shorter turnaround. Why is it that we don't play both men's semifinals on Friday night? It would mean that one side of the draw obviously has 3 days to prepare for their semi, and one side has two. But But it would mean that both grand finalists would have the exact same period of time to prepare for the most important game in the tournament.
I can see why people make that point, but you know what? If you want the luxury of 2 days off, get the number one in the world.
Yeah, true. That's a good point. And that's the next thing I wanted to talk about is Djokovic just looks so unbeatable at this point. It's worth noting that Nadal wasn't at this tournament. That's another thing we should touch on in a sec. But he didn't have his – I don't think he had his serve broken in the semifinal or the final.
No, he really turned it up. It was incredible the last two games, especially after Stanislas almost upset him. It just suddenly went into full beast mode.
Yeah, I mean, if you can play two matches against Ferrer and Murray and not drop your serve once, that's you know, taking it to a whole nother level. And just the way that he's, you know, that physicality we're talking about, the way that he manages his body allows him to just hit these shots that nobody else in the tennis world could even hope of reaching. Just the leverage he gets out of his awkward body angles and the way he rips these bizarre shots, you know, situations where people would just be playing really defensive shots. He goes for the kill. It's pretty scary stuff if you're anybody not called Djokovic in the men's tennis world right now.
It sure would be. He's just a big gangly lad. He's got a big long reach. If he was a boxer, he'd be having a hell of a good time because he just seems to have really long arms. And to be able to get himself into those positions to hit those shots while he's sliding and flying off the court is completely athletic. But also Murray, he looks bigger.
Yeah, he has steadily put on a little bit more weight. And he just, I think the thing we've always said about him, and it's the mental edge, right? That's the thing he's got. He just kept his head right.
Yeah, and I think that's getting better. I mean, he's becoming more consistent, which is a good thing. So give him another year and he's just going to be a little bit later to bloom, I think, than somebody like a Djokovic in terms of getting to full strength, but he's not far off.
So the thing I did obviously mention before is Nadal, and how much of a factor can he still be in the men's? Because I was very interested to read in a Grantline article earlier this week that he's only a year older than Novak at this point. Obviously, he's got some more miles under his tires, but he is the wild card in this mix, surely.
He is, but his body also breaks, and I see that they want to make drug testing more stringent in tennis, so he'll probably be gone pretty quick anyway.
Yeah, we called that one about a year before anybody else, just saying.
Well, how's this? I was reading about it today. Novak Djokovic took more home for winning the Australian Open than they budget for the entire drug testing scene for the whole year.
It's not good.
I mean, that's just absurd. Of course people could juice. But look, he keeps breaking down. His knees aren't holding up. He's got issues with his shoulders. Everything just seems to be falling apart. And yes, he is only a year older than Djokovic, but he's just in really bad physical health.
So, but what happens if Nadal says, look, I've got so many more Grand Slams than anybody else at this point. I'm going to take an entire calendar year off tennis. No competitive tennis. Just get right. Do all the surgeries, do all the rehab, and then come back. Do you think that fixes it, or is it really now just down to Novak and everybody else is watching?
I think he'll probably even have a hard time beating Novak, because Novak doesn't seem to be bothered by the high topspin, because he's got a big double-handed backhand and a lot of power out of that as well.
And crazy defensive game.
Yeah, exactly. And he can go toe-to-toe with Nadal in terms of the long rallies, because that was a big Nadal thing, was extending rallies against Federer and getting a lot of topspin, whereas none of that seems to phase Nadal, phase Djokovic. Being tall helps as well. That's going to eliminate the topspin a bit more. So I still can't see him beating Djokovic on a regular basis.
Yeah. All right. I think that'll do us for this week. We're just going to quickly kick over to a quick chat with Liam Quinn, who is a Baltimore Ravens man. So I want to quickly check in with him and see how he's feeling before the big game. But Kirk, it is a pleasure as always, and I look forward to speaking to you next week.
That'll be great. Tell Liam not to throw his back out doing the dance.
Doing the chicken dance. All right. Talk to you next week, Kirk.
All right. Catch up.
And now we're just going to switch it over for a quick touching of bases with Liam Quinn, who is a Ravens fan and is about to watch his first Super Bowl that he's heavily invested in. How's it going, Liam?
Good, Eric. How are you? Nice to be here again.
Thanks for coming on. So yeah, more importantly than how I am, because I still frankly haven't figured out who I'm going for in this game, is how are you going? I mean, you getting nervous at this point, or?
No, honestly, I think it might be a little bit more nerve-wracking, a little bit probably Monday morning and things like that, but at the moment it's still, you know, it's because it's been a week and a half since they won through to it, so it still seems like it's kind of just in the build-up at the moment, if that makes sense. It's a bit different with that Fortnite break.
It's brutal with the Fortnite break because you get so excited winning the championship game, and then you always think about a Super Bowl and you have to put up with this 2 weeks of bullshit where you don't really know anything. Like, there's no real journalism that's happening in these weeks, and everything's so overanalyzed. It's kind of hard to build up that anticipation until you hear the anthem on Monday morning.
It's just lucky we had the Pro Bowl to tide us over.
Yeah, well, quality viewing that was. So is there anything in particular you're anticipating or looking forward to as an experience here compared to other Super Bowls you've watched?
I think it is a little bit interesting because I normally just watch from a very kind of bipartisan point of view. Obviously, I think I was about 10 years old when they won the last one. So it's been a while since, so I don't really have too many memories of that. But it'll be interesting just to see it. But I mean, you're still kind of watching it, even though I obviously have a certain affinity for Baltimore, that's, you know, you still have to kind of be objective with it and things like that. So it'll be interesting to see how I kind of balance that out, I think, on Monday.
Yeah, they're generally pretty frantic games, just because it seems like everyone struggles to play to the highest level in the game. What are you most invested in as an outcome? Is it Ray for you at this point? Is it seeing him get another ring?
Obviously that's a big factor, but it's also people like, you know, Ed Reed, who has said he's going to play next year, but you know, he kind of says that every year around this time and then almost walks away in the off season. So he could easily get to, you know, August and think, well, I've got a Super Bowl, I don't really need to come back. And it's even people like, you know, Suggs and Bolden and Nader and things that have been great players for a long time now that haven't really done it. So it's obviously good for Ray to send him off with a win and things. But there's also a lot of other pretty, you know, experienced long-term players that have been in Baltimore for a long time, most of them, that have been pretty close but never quite got there. So it'd be good if they can get one.
Yeah, I guess the one thing I would say as well from your perspective is that you've almost had the benefit of perspective from seeing the Ravens. They've been a very competitive team for the last four or five seasons at least, and they've come so close on a number of occasions. So I think it's clear, you know, that there's a lot of randomness and luck that goes into just getting there. So, I mean, I'm assuming you're not under the illusion that this is going to be the first of a string of Super Bowl appearances necessarily, that this is, you know, you've got to strike when the iron's hot here.
Yeah, I doubt it. I doubt it's a start of a 4 or 5 year dynasty. But but really, they've, you know, as you said, they were a Billy kind of kick away from being in this situation last year. And, you know, I mean, who knows what would have happened there? And they've been pretty close at times in the past. So it's kind of it almost feels like this is almost the end of their kind of run in a lot of ways, when they've been so close. And then this is the chance when they've kind of got over that hurdle. And then it's, you know, because you think that they'll have to definitely retool a little bit as their players get older still in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I'd agree. And it almost feels, I think that's been such a driving force of momentum for this team, that it feels like this is the logical next step for them to, and they seem ready for it. All right, very quickly now, I'm just going to ask you for a few factors in this Super Bowl that I think are interesting and see how much they're stressing you out. We'll keep this simple. We'll go from a 1 to 5 scale, where 1 is you're not sweating and 5 is you're on suicide watch. So first of all, how about the fact that this is in the Dome in New Orleans? Are you upset about the fact that it's an indoor game?
No, not at all. I think the Ravens' best offensive strength is that Flacco can throw the ball about 70 yards when he gets behind it. And in a Dome, there's no wind. We saw in that Foxborough game how impactful the wind was on the ability to throw the ball for both sides. So in theory, perfect conditions inside a Dome, then, yeah, that's almost a benefactor for them.
Okay, so we'll chalk that up as a one. How about the crowd factor here? What are you thinking about that?
Again, probably like, you know, maybe stretch it to a 2. But, I mean, it's Super Bowl draw. It's a little bit of a strange crowd because it's a lot of it is corporate seating and things like that. And if anything, I think the Baltimore would largely have a bit of kind of public support because of the whole kind of, I know he hasn't been that popular all his career with Lewis retiring. I think there's a certain group of people that kind of want to see him get one on the way out. So It's not like it's an away game, so to speak. It's just another – it's a mutual game, really.
Yeah, don't rule out the weight of the 49ers being a pretty public team with a lot of bandwagon jumpers on at this point. But I agree. I think the swinging fans will probably be going for Baltimore as the mild underdog in this game.
And the bandwagon can't really afford seats for the Super Bowl, so it's kind of I think in bars and things, they'd probably be more popular than Niners, but it's all corporate seats, so you can't get in if you're a fan. So it's all just people in suits and stuff, so I don't think it's a big deal.
True. Okay, so how about the fact that the Ravens are yet to play the 49ers in their current form? I kind of don't read a lot into the game you got over the Colts in the playoffs so far. I think that's clearly the one that was the least significant here. And obviously in the second two games against the Broncos and the Patriots, you had the benefit of familiarity there. So what about the fact that this is a bit fresher?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, they obviously beat the Niners last year, who were largely the same team except for obviously Kaepernick at quarterback. But, yeah, they did pretty well against the Redskins, even though they did lose in the end, who is a rushing quarterback. They've played against quarterbacks that can move a bit in the past, and they normally do okay. They did it up against Vic earlier in the year when he was actually playing pretty well and wasn't hurt. They ran the Eagles pretty tight in Philly, and it's, again, a mobile quarterback and things. And it's, yeah, if they were younger and stuff like that, the Ravens, I think, would be a concern. But when you've got kind of cool heads like, you know, Reed, Lewis, Suggs, and Nardi, you've pretty much got coaches on the field anyway. So I don't think it's too big of an issue.
Fair enough.
So I'll say a three.
That one. Okay. Yeah, how about the fact that this Niners defense is by far the best that that the Ravens have faced since catching fire, and the secondary especially is the best at covering the deep balls with the state that Champ Bailey was in when you beat up on them?
Well, I think the defense is probably the biggest concern. I'd say probably a four, really. But, I mean, it's not going to get talked about as much as everyone's going to talk about Kaepernick and all the damage he can do. But the Niners defense is, you know, one of the best in the last couple of years. That's pretty much what they've rode these last two seasons. But I think it'd be interesting to see after, obviously, they were kind of considered a deep ball team a lot of the season when Torrey Smith was getting covered pretty heavily. But then Anquan Boldin's been statistically the best receiver in the playoffs so far, and he's more of a kind of in and under sort of guy. So if they check onto him a bit more, maybe it'll give Smith a chance to get deep. And they're still speedy guys like Toby Jones and stuff, and they can work Ray Rice in on the flats and things. So hopefully they should be okay. But, yeah, I think a four is a defensive concern.
Okay. You mentioned the fact that you've faced some athletic offenses so far this year and done okay against, you know, at holding them back. What about the fact that, I mean, especially in the current state that your defense is in, you really haven't seen anybody who's been a successful deep passer of the ball recently?
Well, I think it certainly hasn't happened just recently, but it's kind of, I know it's a little bit cliche to say, but I think the defense in the last 3 weeks in the playoffs has been completely separate in a lot of ways performance-wise to what it was during the season. So they're obviously all got a little bit of extra inspiration and things like that. And they are playing pretty well. Obviously, they got 35 points put up against them by Denver, but that was two kick returns in that, while one kick and one punt return. So there's still only really three touchdowns. And then against the Patriots last week, they held them to 13. So they've been able to keep some pretty prolific offenses in the low scoring elements purely as an offensive way when you discount those kick returns for Denver.
Yeah, but neither of those teams were – I don't think Brady or Manning are particularly handy at passing deeper than 20 yards at this point in their career.
Not deep, but I think in a lot of ways, if they know that one of the things that Kaepernick is going to do is try to throw deep, then they can kind of adjust to it and things. And I think, as I was saying before, that the experience and things like that of some of the key players should help them be able to see what's going on early in the game or try to force him to really do what he wouldn't want to do, which is throw some more short passes.
So finally, how about the fact that, in my opinion, Joe Flacco has to win the Super Bowl for you, not Ray Rice?
Well, I think Flacco is probably a four as a concern, but I mean, he's been very good, obviously, these playoffs, but even his whole career, he's been very good in the playoffs. I think he's got, what, 8 playoff wins now, 9 playoff wins, something. So he's doing well, and I mean, he's kind of, you know, he came back, as bad as Denver's pass defense was, he came back and beat Denver, who were one of the, you know, considered to be a favorite. He beat Tom Brady really for the second year in a row. He outperformed him anyway. But and then, you know, took advantage of a few situations that benefited him as well, obviously. But I don't think it's as, you know, if you were asking that question 2 months ago, I think I'd be a little bit more concerned. But he's kind of proven in the playoffs that he is able to step up and make some big throws.
So it sounds like the Niners defense is the thing that worries you the most at this point.
Niners defense is definitely the concern. And obviously Kaepernick to some degree when you've seen what he's done these playoffs, but I think the defense will be smart enough to be able to keep him off balance and to force him into some mistakes and things he doesn't want to do.
Terrific. All right, well, I'll stop torturing you there, Liam. I think at this point all I can do is wish you the best for Monday and I hope you enjoy the game.
Thanks, Eric.
I went to the 2020 on Monday night on the public holiday, Australia versus Sri Lanka.
Oh, that'd be good. Did you get excited by the fireworks? Fire!
I did have the fireworks and the fact that they had both Bogan Australian cheerleaders and Australians dressed as Bollywood cheerleaders that danced whenever a six or a wicket was taken.
Oh, boy.
It was really bad. Like, I was expecting it to be bad, but it was incredibly bad.
That is so tacky.
I have never heard I've never seen something so dull with 40,000 people at a game. There was no atmosphere there at all.
No, it was struggling a bit, was it?
Just average. It was just, I mean, it was a weird game as well. You know, obviously, Australia decided to pick a bar fight after they lost. But the one highlight for me was somehow we ended up sitting in the Sri Lankan support section. Those guys rock.
So much fun. They get the trumpets out.
Yep.
Get the drums.
Yep, they just sung and danced for the entire match, which in 2020 wasn't that long, but still, well, they enjoy cricket so much more than we do.
Oh, 100%. We have our modesty, I guess. I don't know what it is, if it's shame, or we just politely clap and say yes, or yell Aussie, 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 oi, oi, oi. They get the drums out and it's a party all day.
But yeah, the moral of the story for me here, Kirk, is 2020, never again.
Nah, not a fan.